Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Talking to Ourselves podcast. I'm Omid Farhang, founder at Majority. My guest today, Devika Bulchandani, joined Ogilvy in 2021, where she serves as global president. That makes Dev the first ever woman of color to run a global agency network. Prior to joining Ogilvy, Dev had a storied 26-year career at McCann, most recently as president of McCann North America. She led MasterCard's Priceless campaign. In 2017, she helped bring to life the iconic Fearless Girl, making McCann one of the most awarded agencies in the world. In 2019, she was recognized by Campaign Magazine as U.S. Advertising Agency Head of the Year. Dev is also a founding member of Time's Up Advertising, where she has tirelessly championed equality for women in advertising. 2017, she was named Working Mother of the Year by She Runs It, and is also a previous recipient of the Ad Color Innovator Award. And it bears mentioning, in the time since we recorded this interview, Ogilvy was named Global Network of the Year at Cannes. This is my friend, Devika Bulchandani, and I talking to ourselves. Devika Bulchandani, where are you from and what did your parents do?
I'm from India, and my parents, my mom raised four of us, though I think she basically ran the whole world. And my dad was in the textile business and made fabric. And then that evolved into a studio business, which has now become studios in Mumbai, where you shoot ads and you shoot TV serials, movies, whatever it is that you want to do. So it's kind of funny how I came from a family, a business family of like textile people, and all of a sudden we're like all in this, you know, all of us, my sister is a cinematographer, my brothers manage this studio, I am in advertising. And it's just really funny how to see a textile family business has all evolved into all of us doing what I'd call sort of, you know, roughly the, I mean, not roughly, it's the creative field in one size, shape, or form.
Did you aspire to be in a creative field growing up? What did 12-year-old Dev want to be when she grew up?
One thing super clear, I didn't want to have an arranged marriage. And there's a really bizarre, my mother talks about it and I remember it very vividly. I wanted to go to bed tired. And I so regret feeling that way as a 12 and 13-year-old. I was fortunate. I grew up, you know, privileged in India. And I just sort of thought everybody led this life of, just everything felt a bit empty and relaxed. And I was like, I want to work and I want to be independent. And I want to make my own money and I want to be tired when I go to bed. And God, did that come true. And God, did I wish I was a little less tired going to bed every day. But I'm super happy that I do what I do.
Sometimes
when you love what you do and you go to bed tired, it's satisfying.
Sometimes I go to bed and I'm like, I don't know what to make of the fact that getting into this bed right now feels like the highlight of my day.
And then, you know, when you get into bed, there's so often my kids or my husband, they walk in and I look at them and I'm like, I'm done with my words. I have no words left. I have nothing left to say.
I know. It's really interesting working remotely and working from home. And you know, it's like you walk out of your home office or your workspace and your family's right there. And in the ways that maybe we would come home and interact with our spouses and tell our spouses about our day, you know, I feel like sometimes the greatest gift you can give your spouse is to not ask them about their day, because it forces us to relive the whole thing. It's like, would it be okay if I didn't talk about my day at all? It was a great day. I want that to be in the rearview mirror, and I just want to be with my family without thinking about my
work. I mean, that's so funny. My son, who also, he's going to start a job at UTA in LA, wants to be in the film world, like your brother. He wants to know all about my work. What meetings were you in? And then I look at him and I'm like, sweetie, I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk to you about something else. And he gets so frustrated because he wants to know everything that's happening in my life and work because he's interested in it. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about it.
Prior to joining Ogilvy in 2021, you spent 26 years at McCann. Is that correct? Okay. So you get there, that puts you roughly in the mid-90s. Mid-90s, what was McCann like and what were you like and how did the two mix?
You know, I'm an immigrant and first generation, and I get to McCann, and before McCann for 2 years, I was at Anderson and Lemke, which McCann bought. So I come to advertising, and my first sort of memory is at McCann, somebody talking about Tiger in the Tank. And I'm just sort of sitting there going, what does that mean? You know, and everybody's sort of reminiscing about Hilltop and Tiger in the Tank. And these were such sort of dominant McCann. And they were cultural icons, and I didn't know anything. And when you talk about, you know, at that point we had Nabisco and all the crackers. And I was like, I don't know what those crackers are. I don't know what those brands are. People talk about all this stuff with nostalgia. And I'm like, I don't know the nostalgia of any of it. That it was I felt out of place. And I always say a little less in the beginning about being a woman or being a person of color. At that point, actually, just the cultural difference, because we work in such a cultural industry, right? Like, and now, by the way, you talk to me about something from the last 20 years in our industry, and I know it because I've been a part of it. But at that point, I really felt like I didn't know, and I couldn't participate in those conversations, and I felt like a real outsider.
Yeah. When we think about the Mad Men era of advertising, you know, McCann is grouped into that legacy, and the final scene of Mad Men, the sort of triumphant scene, is the production of a commercial that is actually McCann's probably most famous commercial, Hilltop, as you mentioned. And, you know, as you found your footing at this company where, you know, I know for me, when I was ever on the 28th floor or 29th floor of McCann, I could just sort of feel the ghosts of white male executives in fedoras, you know, smoking cigarettes and roaming the halls. You know, as a brown immigrant woman, you know, and that didn't really totally understand all of these cultural reference points, and advertising people love to use, you know, past culture to create future culture. It gives us sort of something to compare it to. It gives us frame of reference. It gives us a shorthand to describe what we envision in a way that people can understand. You know, what were some of the sort of steps that you felt like you needed to take to find that sense of belonging that you were initially missing? Or was it just a matter of time? It was just, you just had to your time.
Look, I think some of it was a matter of time. But I will tell you, McCann absolutely has such a strong perception of being a boys' club. And it was, to a large extent. But it also had like iconic women like Nina DeSessa and Joyce King Thomas. So it was this very bizarre, and by the way, creative leaders before anybody ever thought about, you know, now we all talk about having women creative leaders, but there was Nina and Joyce. So my career at McCann before my dearest friend today, and I don't even, and a friend is not doing him service. I don't know, my brother or like Rob Riley or Sean and Tom and Eric, before all these guys, they were women.
Yeah.
So it had this very interesting sort of balance of creative leadership in my growing up years being women, but then having this real sort of boys club, and McCann no doubt has a masculine energy to it. And sometimes I say I have masculine energy to my, you know, like we all, by the way, have energy is a different thing. And I think most people have a little bit of masculine energy, a little feminine energy. But McCann has it's like an alpha energy.
Sure. And over that 26 years, you just see the way that a company like that changes as the industry is changing. Like in the late 90s, early 2000s, wasn't there like a white glove sort of lunch, like formal lunch that was served to exec, like the idea of like a formal lunch served by guys in tails is so bizarre to think about now, but that wasn't that far from the truth, right?
No, it was totally the truth. When I was sort of super young, my aspiration was, when am I going to get to the dining room? Right? Because you got to a certain level and you got a fridge, but the most important thing is you got to have lunch in the dining room. Right? So I've always had a very naughty streak, and I always say, and I think it's true to our industry and what we do. And I tell my kids this, rules are meant to be broken. I mean, if we all just color between the lines, then we're never going to do new things. We're never going to create sort of new products. So I think, you know, creative cultures have to have a bit of mischief in them. And I think I was sort of the instigator of a lot of that mischief, and I'll never forget. I went and stole the keys to the wine cabinet in that kitchen. So I was like, if I don't have access, I'm going to get myself some access. And I figured out how they had, where they would put the keys. And I went and stole some wine. And I swear to God, I felt like I had arrived just getting that one bottle of wine. And it wasn't about the bottle of wine. It was that I got it from that 28th floor kitchen.
Right.
And then the next day, by the way, I bragged about it, told everybody I did it because that was the fun. yes, it is. Those images, those symbols, that world, I think when, and by the way, you know, a little less probably for you because you, even though I look younger than you, most likely, right? It was true. It was all true.
You spent much of the first half of your career as a strategist. And that title of strategist can just mean so many different things. You know, there are strategists that are, when you get down to brass tacks, what they really are data analysts. And then there are strategists that are secretly the best creatives in the room, or strategists that are the best account people in the room. How would you describe Devika, the strategist, stylistically?
More the second two buckets that you said than sort of, you know, my strategist mantra would always be, you make shit up and then you back it up. But take that in, you know, not in a, in sort of the spirit of creativity, as in that's what we do. You know, we make new realities, we imagine new worlds. But, and I always sort of went at it that way. But I always say, even now, every decision we make, what does strategy mean? By the way, you're a strategist. What does strategy mean? Strategy means making a choice to get to a destination. Right?
Yeah.
You want to go from your house in Atlanta to the airport, you can go 12 different ways. You're going to look at data to say what time of day it is, what's the traffic pattern. You look at ways, you create a strategy to say what's the best way to get there.
And you're going to decide what's important to you. Is the fastest route the most important? Is the most beautiful route the most important?
Exactly. It's a choice.
Right.
You take input, you make a choice to get to a destination. Every decision I have to make in my current role are these choices. If we have a bad meeting with a client, I have to make a strategic choice. Should I call her or should somebody else call her or him? How do we deal with that situation? If you have an employee that's unhappy about something, what do we do? Do we give somebody a counter offer? Do we not? That's a strategic choice.
Right.
So I think sometimes we tend to put things in silos, but I think strategic and creative thinking is the one thing that ties all of us together.
Yeah. I think there's some kind of negative perception of the idea of agencies that have come up with an idea first and then quote unquote backed into a strategy. But I think the best creatives, when they hear an idea or when they think of an idea, regardless of who it comes from, often the best idea in the room may not even come from a creative, they instantly know it's good. And then they start to think about why they instantly know it's good. And it very rarely is about strictly the artistic merits of the idea. You know, there's this instinctual feeling that this idea will work. And then you start to you slow your adrenaline down and you start to ask, why am I having this reaction? And in asking that why, you start to, almost like an attorney, you start to build your case for the idea, you know? And
gut and intuition are important sort of, you know, variables. And two, it's not to say that, I mean, we've knowledge built over years. Right? It's not to say that just because I'm in a particular category or working in a category, I suddenly don't know how consumers behave. I mean, that's what we've done all our lives. So it's not like I know I laugh and say make shit up, but all of that's based on experience, on our understanding of consumers and human behavior at the broadest sort of sense. But let me just go beyond that. You know, like the story about when the Walkman was created, there was no data. It was observation of human behavior that people were taking their boom boxes on their shoulders and walking on the streets. And it's like, interesting. What if we just make it more portable? Right. So I think sometimes we tend to use data as a proxy for understanding human behavior, by the way, which doesn't necessarily have to only come from data. It comes from observation. It comes from behavioral science. It comes from just sort of understanding and being curious. I don't know if Elon Musk had data, by the way, that he needed to say that we needed to have electric, you know, cars. Like, I really don't. He's like, the world's going to hell.
Right.
That's a big enough data point, right? Like, we need to save the planet and we need to have a different way of being able to transport ourselves.
Data is so easy to weaponize too. I mean, I think we're all guilty of essentially building the case for an idea around our gut, our instinct, our love of observational science and anthropology and human behavior. And if you have that in your back pocket, or if you have that as your bedrock, rather, you're going to be able to find data points that, you know, that ease the fears of a client who feels like they need that to get them over the finish line.
And I think it's not just the client, but even for ourselves, right? Like I would say, when we come up with ideas, they're hypotheses. Hey, this could be really, that's a hypothesis.
Yeah.
And then you go and you see, is my hypothesis indeed true? Science works like that. You create a hypothesis and then you do the experiment to figure out, like, that's what we do. We create creative hypotheses, right? To say, we think, based on everything that we know, that this could work really well. And sometimes, by the way, you take young people, it's not based on everything they know because of experience. It's based on everything they know because they're the target audience.
Right.
Right. And then you go, okay, let me now look at what's happening in the world to see, is my creative hypothesis, you know, does it indeed have some foundation?
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. I think science works that way. I don't know why. And I think we do, by the way. I think our industry actually does work that way. In its most poetic, sort of beautiful form, it kind of does work that way, right? It's not a linear analysis of something. It's sort of an upside down, this fact from here, that fact from here. You know, you come up with a creative hypothesis or an idea, what I'm calling the hypothesis, the creative idea, and then you go, wait, does that make sense? You learn something else, and then you pivot it and change it.
I've never thought of that before. You're right, though. I think the creative process does more closely parallel the scientific process than I think probably creatives like to acknowledge, because we like to think about those two things as separate. But there are
science,
actually a lot of...
Science is fundamentally creative, right?
Right.
Fundamentally creative. And I genuinely believe that it is very similar to, we have a creative hypothesis, they have a scientific hypothesis.
Now, there are certain brands we work on during our formative years that we can never sort of emotionally untangle ourselves from. I started my career working on Volkswagen, and I feel like it's, you know, once a Volkswagen creative, always a Volkswagen creative, and I'm always kind of paying attention. What was that formative brand for you?
That's so funny that you asked me that question, because I bumped into these clients two nights ago. It's MasterCard, right? I mean, it'll always hold an extremely special place in my heart. And I always feel like, I don't know, that a part of me is part of the brand, and that's been super, super sort of, we all sort of have, you know, like, you're right, we all have that one brand. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Fearless Girl. I mean, that, you know, like.
We're going to come to the Fearless Girl, which was a moment.
And then, I feel like, you know, I've only been here a year, so it takes a little longer than a year to start feeling sort of that sense of deep connection with a brand, but Dove and IBM certainly. And, you know, IBM I've been deeply involved with. And the power of, again, what, you know, we just sort of repositioned IBM as actually a creative brand, talking about what technology can do and what they can do to create new realities for business, to create new revenue streams, to create new, you know, sort of innovation, whatever it is. And Dove, of course.
Yeah. With MasterCard, I mean, when you started working on MasterCard, the priceless platform had begun. But was that sort of the main emphasis when you first joined the brand, or was it being phased out? Like, sort of where, because to me that is, you know, one of the 10 most iconic campaigns.
It wasn't being phased out. It's, you know, it's so core to the MasterCard brand. It was being evolved, certainly, in a more modern interpretation, and as opposed to being just sort of an ad campaign, it was really becoming a business idea. And even with, you know, some of the work like the True Name card, those are business solutions.
Yeah. It's one of the great challenges is, like, there are these brands that you join along the journey of their sort of iconic success. And each of us selfishly wants to leave our mark. And so, you know, you go join Wieden Kennedy, and what are you going to do with Just Do It to add your face to a Mount Rushmore of 50 faces that came before you? And what was true there is true of MasterCard as well. Did you sort of feel this pressure of, like, how do we maintain the standard? How do I put my mark on this?
Look, I've been in McCann all through the MasterCard journey, but for probably the first 10 years of my life or so, I didn't touch it that much, right? But all of us had touched it in some form during the pitch. And it always felt like it was sort of, you know, it was born out of such a strategic sort of reframe that from a planning department standpoint, everybody sort of felt really closely, felt close to it. And then when I started working on it more directly, I worked with Joyce King Thomas, who created Priceless. So I never had that sort of feeling of what's my mark on it, because I came into it with her.
Right.
And I think both, and we'd been partners for so long, and she, you know, she was CCO when I was head of planning, that it was sort of a very organic thing to say, how do we move this forward? And then Raja, the CMO, current CMO, he came in and he was also like, loved the platform, but said, how do we move it forward and modernize it?
In 2014, you get your first major promotion at McCann from a planning role into a president role. What was the greatest challenge you had to overcome in making that transition into this new echelon of leadership, especially at an agency where I think when you've been at a place for a long time, they see you a certain way and it's hard for them to see you a new way. You know, did you experience that? What were some of the challenges there?
The biggest challenge personally for me was to walk into a room and not be a planner. So that was a personal challenge for me, right? And I always say, I walk into a room, I haven't thought about things as deeply as planners do. So even when I'm shooting the shit with planners, please don't take what I said seriously, because I haven't thought it through. You know, I have to keep sort of reminding myself that I'm not the planner in the room. And that was a challenge. Now I feel it way less. I think that was sort of my biggest transition moment, how not to be seen as a planner and how to be seen as a leader. I have a total sort of renewed appreciation for account people, because, you know, us planners and creatives would always put them down. And I actually think they have really tough jobs. You know, when an account's not making money, it's their fault. When the creative is great, the creative people do, you know, they get the credit. When we have a phenomenal meeting because we know the brand and we understand the consumer, the strategists get all the credit. So really putting myself in their shoes and being able to understand them and them feeling that I understood them and was actually their proponent and champion. And that was that was work for me to do. And then I think the more you do it, it just sort of becomes organic.
Yeah.
We all have ADHD. Like I don't have an attention span. So frankly, this suits me really well because I can do a little of this, a little of that, a little of this, like, you know what I mean? So I absolutely love it. And I owe a lot of this to Harris, who, you know, the way it happened, it's a funny story. He called me into his office one day and was like, what do you want to do? And I didn't know him that well. And I said,
this is Harris Diamond, then CEO of McCain.
Yep. I said, what do you mean? He's like, what do you want to do with your life? And I'm like, that's a weird conversation. Like, I don't really know you that well. So it was like, it's awkward. I said, I don't understand what you're asking me. He said, I don't think you should be a strategist anymore. So I looked at him and I was like, so what am I going to do? He looks at me, he goes, I don't know. We'll figure it out. So I said, okay. It was just, and then I walked out of his office and I called my husband. I said, I had this really weird meeting with Harris. But, you know, Harris was really great about, you know, he would keep sort of every literally 18 months giving me more and more responsibility. And at one point I spoke to him and I said, I don't understand why I have to go through all these steps. And he said, because I want to make sure you never fail. So you're going to do every step. So you're and like, and I owe him so much for making sure that he was systematic in the way my sort of transition happened, the way I took on more and more responsibility. And at the same time, he let me do things in the way that I needed to do them, as opposed to, you know, let me be me and not make me into somebody else. Anyway, I owe Harris a shit ton.
You brought up Fearless Girl. Fearless Girl goes down as one of the most famous advertising moments of the past decade. I feel like once the meteor hits and mankind is gone, that statue, some alien species will stumble upon that statue covered in vines. Our mutual brother, Rob Riley, is the first to say that Fearless Girl would have never seen the light of day without you. So, Dev, you don't work at McCann anymore. Come on, tell the people the real story of the 48 hours leading up to that statue being installed on Wall Street.
It would never have happened without Stephen Tisdale, who's, you know, the thing in our industry is agencies can come up with the best ideas in the world, and we can have people at agencies who know how to make things happen. But if you don't have CMOs and partners, and Stephen Tisdale at State Street at that point, he's not there anymore. And even with Priceless, it was, you know, Raja, Cheryl, Monica, like all these people. We need client partners. And the 48 hours leading up to Fearless Girl were intense. We're really intense. And I'm going to take 48 and take some liberty and make it, you know, 72 or 96. And, you know, Fearless Girl was named, I think 3 or 4 days before she was named. And it was, you know, Rob's sort of being the instigator. She was called the She Statue because it was the She Fund. And I spoke.
That's not as good.
It's just not. Doesn't sound as good. And by the way, it was like really well planned, right? Fearless Girl, Charging Bull. Like right. It was. That's my phone ringing. We're going to ignore it. So the name, right? And as you can imagine, there were lots of technical hiccups. You know, we had to build a foundation. We had to overnight get her in there. So there were a ton of technical sort of hiccups and operational hiccups. But that partnership with Stephen, with the CEO, with John Brockelman, that every single time there was something happened, I picked up the phone, I talked to them, we sorted it through, and them not looking at us saying, how could this happen? Because that happens very often. And I tell clients to say, if we're going to do new kinds of things that have never been done before, guess what? Nor do we know. We know how to make a TV ad. Right. And we've done it for 50 years in radio and print. So if there's a major hiccup there, I get it. Like that's, you know, that's stupid on our part. But when we're doing innovation and innovative ideas, I don't know either.
And you have attorneys, maybe State Street attorneys or McCann attorneys the night before saying, don't do this.
And there was, but everybody held hands and said, this needs to be done. Right. You know, it was like, this needs to be done. And that's all State Street. The courage, the conviction that this needed to happen, that Fearless Girl needed to go up, I got to give the clients all the credit.
Before we transition to Ogilvy, let's just close the book on McCann. 26 years, you grew up there, you watched colleagues grow up there. raise kids. You know, you lived multiple lives there. It becomes part of your identity at a certain point. Tell me about the decision to leave and how you even begin to say goodbye after 26 years.
McCann is always going to be a part of me. Always, always, always. McCann gave my children a godmother. McCann gave my children grandparents. These are people I met there who are my family today. McCann for 26 years has been incredibly good to me. Incredibly good to me. I was an immigrant who came here. It became my home. It became my family. I got to put my thumbprint on it. That's my child who used to come there when he was 2 years old in a suit. And I don't think, you know, like India is always going to be part of me. I grew up there. I'm Indian. And I feel like McCann's always going to be part of me. There's a story of my life, which is Devett McCann. And, you know, just because you life evolves and you move on, it's not like that story ended. It's that chapter ended. And my memories, my feelings, my gratitude, I don't even know how to put it in words, right? Because it was such an important and integral part of who I am. And it gave me the foundation for where I am today. And I can't forget that. My decision was based on a simple fact. Two simple facts, if I'm being totally honest. One was a genuine reckoning that, oh my God, COVID, we could all die. We all sort of faced the existential issue, right? Like we did. So literally one day I'm going, so wait a minute, if I get COVID and I die, and there's like a memorial for me, it'll be like, she worked at McCann. It was like, I think my story needs another chapter. I was like, I need to do something else. That's kind of like, just need something else, right? Like, so uninteresting. She worked at McCann. And at the same time, there was another reality, which is, you know, McCann was going through a change of guard. And it felt like a chapter was ending and a new one was going to begin. And it felt like the neat and clean moment to say when a chapter is being, you know, when you're sort of turning the page on a chapter, it just felt very neat. I didn't have this guilt or something to say. I had guilt about leaving people. I had guilt about clients, but I didn't feel like I was, and I'm a woman, Indian woman, so guilt's a really big thing, obviously. I sort of felt like I was leaving at a neat and clean time. And to take my story forward, for me to grow, for me to know, can I do this somewhere else? Because when you get comfortable, when you're so entrenched, right? It's like, can I do this somewhere else? Or it's actually McCann versus me. I had to know that for myself.
And then you started Ogilvy in 2021 and, you know, first you're CEO of Ogilvy New York, and then you're quickly promoted to global president, which I believe makes you the first woman of color to run a global network agency.
That's what I think. When it happened, David Ford and I were trying to figure it out, and we think, and we haven't gone back a gazillion years, but yes.
And you do that at yet another agency established in the sort of white male dominated Mad Men era, no less. So tell me about your first year, being the first Devika Bulchandari rather than trying to be the next David Ogilvy or many of those predecessors.
I think one of the things that was really important to me is not to come in. Ogilvy is a very strong culture, a very strong networked culture.
Yeah.
You know, we have people here like Carla Hendra and Patu, who runs our consulting business, and Patu, who runs EMEA for us, and Kent and Chris, who run APAC, and, you know, Sophie Hofstetter and Joe Shiroda. There's so many people who have been here a really long time that one of the critical things for me was not to come in and be one of those, you know, leaders who comes in and says, all right, we're here to change everything. Is actually to understand the culture, to protect it, and to nurture a new evolution of it. Because we do all need to evolve. We evolve as people, cultures and organizational cultures need to evolve. I spoke to David Ogilvy's wife, Herta, last January, as just to understand. And actually, Liz, Mick, and I, and Joe Shirota were going right after Cannes to visit her in Tufu. I spoke to Joel Raphaelson, who was a writer with David Ogilvy's, you know, in his time. Shelley has been on speed dial, Shelley Lazarus, for me, just so that I can, again, understand where Ogilvy is coming from and then figure out how to move it forward, but with you know, paying sort of homage to the core of the brand. It is an iconic, it is probably, I shouldn't say that, it is the most iconic brand in our industry. Like, I think we'd all agree. So, and in doing that, there's a very fascinating thing. When you come into new cultures, when you understand them and you spend a little time understanding them, you feel them and you feel a part of them. When you don't do that, you actually don't feel part of these cultures. And I have to tell you today, as much, I mean, I just spoke about McCann, and now I feel like, oh my God, I've been at Ogilvy all my life. Like, this is where I belong. And I don't know if that makes me a schizophrenic person or a bad person, but I absolutely and utterly have come to appreciate, love the core of Ogilvy. And Ogilvy is a networked family. Ogilvy is a thinking, you know, they call it the teaching hospital, and it really is the teaching hospital. It's such a deep sort of thinker's culture, not an advertising culture, really. It's much more of sort of this marketing sort of thinking. And Liz feels the same way, by the way. You know, she came back, so she knew the Ogilvy culture and loved it. And she's come back to nurture it forward.
This is Liz Taylor, CCO.
This is Elizabeth Taylor, like I call her.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting because sometimes you take these big jobs, like oftentimes when someone is hired in a role as, you know, as profound as global president, it's because something is severely broken. And so the job is to come in and get people aligned around some big, simple, shared goals and some, you know, our mutual brother, Rob Riley, taught us the value of, you know, introducing new thoughts and new values and new North Stars. You know, and in some ways, the job is actually easier when the place is broken. And on the other hand, you're an ambitious person who certainly views your role as bigger than coming into maintain status quo. So how do you figure out sort of, you know, where to push and pull, where to introduce new thoughts and ideas without doing exactly what you said, which is sort of trampling on the bedrock of the legacy that makes Ogilvy Ogilvy, especially built on these Ogilvy-isms that anytime they pop up on LinkedIn or you see them in a book, it's like they're as relevant today as they were in 1955.
So yes, we clarified a vision and what is it that we're here to do. Very simple. It now tells me 30 minutes, so I can say 12 hours. Reboot, defer reboot, it's gone. It was still hanging out there. We clarified that. We, you know, studied sort of all the David Ogilvy-isms and clarified values. But I just say there's two very simple things that I talk about and I talk about all the time, which is the pursuit of greatness and doing it with goodness. And I think Ogilvy has a responsibility to the industry, not just to the Ogilvy brand, to pursue greatness. And Ogilvy was always at the forefront of what's the next innovation and what's the next sort of thing, whether it was, you know, direct marketing and one-to-one marketing that was created, or it was 360. We still have a robust consulting group, and there's a health group, and, you know, Ogilvy One, which is now called Ogilvy Experience, and PR, all being integrated. I mean, it's always sort of been leading the way. So this pursuit of greatness is not pursuit of greatness in a selfish manner, but pursuit of greatness of how we move the industry forward as Ogilvy, and just doing it with goodness. It's as simple as that, Omid, in our industry, by the way. If you set two things, my belief is Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to live my day today with mediocrity. I don't think anybody wakes up saying, I'd really like to be mediocre today. Right? So having ambition that is rousing and inspiring actually is a really good thing for cultures. And then the second thing is having ambition of how we treat each other makes the ambition of what we want to achieve super easy. So another analogy that I've been talking about a lot is we want to go to the moon. I want to go to Mars. I don't know how to get to Mars, but I can tell you this. I don't know. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be complicated. We're going to take 1 foot forward and then take 3 steps back. That's okay. But let's go to Mars.
Right. You're definitely not going to get there unless you start by saying it and unless you believe it. Yeah.
And there's two things it takes. It takes belief that we can get there, because then the chaos, the frustration of the chaos, all the things that I talked about that get in the way are not as annoying because you're going to Mars and we believe we can get there. And then the other thing is you can't go to Mars alone. One person alone can't figure it out, nor could Elon Musk, right? Like, it's only going to happen if we do it together. So I don't know. I just tend to think we overcomplicate the shit out of our industry. We overcomplicate the shit out of cultures. It's very simple. People want to be ambitious. People want to win. So set a vision.
Listen, your ambition is on center stage. You started with the moon. And even in your analogy, you're like, no, fuck the moon. Mars.
People have been to the moon. Like, and I said it in a meeting with Liam, who runs our Coke business. And I was like, Liam, I know there's a lot of things we don't know, but we're going to Mars.
For presidents and CEOs at ad agencies, you know, proximity to the work varies based on individual style and background and interest. How has sort of the programming of your day changed since becoming global president, just sort of vis-a-vis proximity to the actual creative product? Because my limited interaction with you at McCann, you were pretty hands-on with the creative product.
So, I mean, it's changed a little, obviously, right? However, what can't change is proximity to clients. And if you think about it, what do clients buy from us? Our work. So I don't know how a head of an agency can ever disassociate themselves from the work, because that means you're disassociating yourself from clients. A CEO of a car company is deeply involved in their product, right? Like, they know what's happening with their cars. They spend time with the design, the prototypes, the assembly line, the technology, what's happening, because that's what people buy. Our clients buy our work. And proximity to clients, if you make the mistake as an agency leader not to have proximity to clients, that is, in my opinion, I'm sure there's people who've done it very successfully without having proximity to clients. In my opinion, that's a recipe for not very good things. So if I'm going to say proximity to clients is fundamental to my job, what am I going to be close to them about? I don't golf, nor do they, by the way, anymore. Right? What am I going to be close to them about? Has to be about the work.
If you're not up to speed in the first conversation, it is revealed immediately and you lose credibility in a way that is very difficult to get back, right?
So that to me is the professional side. On the personal side of it, listen, I like this industry because of the work. I actually, on the personal side, like it.
Yeah.
Right? I want, and I always say I'll be assistant AE on 3 ideas a year because I like it. It makes me feel good. I get deep satisfaction from sort of being involved in it and having a thumbprint on it.
Well, just following up there, I mean, given that fact around clients, what can you share about the conversations that you had early on with clients when you first took the helm? Because, you know, in many cases, in almost all cases, you know, they've been in business with Ogilvy since long before you've arrived. So, by the way, is there a little bit of nervousness in those conversations? You know, are you trying to, you know, show them stability? Are you trying to show them change? Does it vary by client? What were those conversations like?
Honesty and transparency. It's like the first thing you do in a conversation is you listen, right? Like as opposed to talk. And the other thing is, by the way, I know we call them clients, but they're also people. It's actually understanding them. It's spending a little bit of time getting to know just the human beings, not just sort of the client side of things. And just honesty. So Ogilvy is this, it's not like most agencies. I mean, every, like agencies just go through sort of an up and down, but you know, we wouldn't be Campaign's Network of the Year and One Show Network of the Year if there was deep instability. It's a pretty solid place because that doesn't happen overnight, right? The foundations and then there's always problems. Every company has problems. Every agency has some problems. But I've always found in all my client interactions, just a spirit of honesty to say, you're right, this isn't working and here's what we're going to do to fix it.
I think it's one of the things you and I share about our love of the industry is no matter how exalted the name of the agency or the name of the brand, at the end of the day, it is just people. You know, we never show up to work and pull giant levers of machinery. Everything boils down to a handful of people who are all trying to row a boat in the same direction, clients and agency. That relationship between client and agency lead, has that changed much in your couple of decades?
I think it has. And I think a factor of that is time. I think the relationships don't feel as deep to me. And it's, I think, time on every side, right? Like there's more agency turnover. Clients, by the way, there's, you know, what's the average tenure of a CMO? So things are just sort of turning over where you don't have the time for partnership. But that's on us a lot, right? A client's, 100% of client's job is not us. 100% of our job is them.
Right.
Right? Like, and I always say this to people when you're like, I'm like, just keep in mind, we are not 100% of their consciousness. They need to be 100% of our consciousness. So it is on us to find ways and mechanisms to foster and nurture the relationships. Because when we do that, and by the way, it's not that clients don't want it. They just don't have the time and we're not the be all and end all of their life. So, you know, we've got to create the initiative. The second thing of it is I like people. I genuinely like people, and clients are people, and they, so many of them have become my friends. You know, like I will say, I've been super fortunate that along the way, it's not clients, but I've sort of got a network of friendships that will outlast anything in this industry. And some of them I've worked with and now I don't work with, and, you know, really, dear friend of mine who's a CMO called me up and said, I need to do a pitch. Do you want to be in it? And I said, I don't think we're right. Right? And she was like, if you want to be in it, I'm going to put you in it. And I said, actually, I don't think we're right. And it was honest friendship because I'm not going to violate that. And I tell people this all the time to say, if our client relationships, we take them seriously, trust is a, don't violate that trust. Do what's right for the client, always do what's right, always.
Yeah, building on that notion of time, like this business has never been more transient than it is today. And I think there was once this sort of great nobility in planting roots and staying at one place for a really long time. Just as, you know, when we looked at a resume where someone had jumped around every couple years, that was viewed as a red flag. In a way that I don't know that that's really the case anymore. So what advice do you give to young executives about managing their careers and planting roots? And has your advice changed at all since basically the advent of LinkedIn?
Yeah, these are choices. I always tell people to say, I was talking to our interns yesterday to say, don't just think about these 2 months that you're going to be here in terms of what did I learn professionally? Think about, Did you create relationships with other interns? Did you pick up friendships along the way? Did you network with other people? Did you expand your mind? Did you have a really bad meeting where you felt totally embarrassed? That's fine. It's not the end of the world. Like, that's all fine. And by the way, if you hate it at the end, acknowledge it. And I say this to everybody to say, just if you're not happy, don't do it. It's just not worth it. Because one thing about our industry, I can't change the hours as much as I'd love to, right? Because again, it's client, right? We're in the client service industry, really. We're professional services. We can manage a few things, but when there's a deadline for a client and they change their mind, what am I going to do? I had to explain this to a young kid. I said, let me tell you, when you all say, we should push back on clients. I said, awesome. They'll go to another agency and then we have to fire people. And it was like, oh, so I said, you see. And I always say it's a choice. And your primary responsibility in making choices is to yourself. Not to me, not to Ogilvy, not to Omid. Now, you can say that's a factor in making a choice. That's your choice. If you want to make dev a factor in your decision, or Ogilvy or Omid, that is a choice you're making. And your primary responsibility is to yourself. And please, if you don't get some joy out of what you do, you're not going to be happy. And if you're not happy, you're not going to be good at your job. If you're not good at your job, you're not going to get raises. If you don't get raises, you're going to be unhappy.
Yeah. Speaking of choices, after coming up on a decade in various president and CEO roles, what have you gotten better at saying no to?
I've gotten a lot better at advocating for myself. It's something I had to really, focus hard on. I got better at negotiating on my own behalf and how to figure out if I'm getting paid not 76 cents to the man's dollar, but hey, if I'm really good at my job, I'd like to get paid more than the man. I've gotten much better at that. And I tell people to say, if you don't advocate for yourself, please don't give me that responsibility. Like, no, you shouldn't, frankly, give anybody that responsibility. Advocate for yourself. And then also be good at your job, because you can't just advocate for yourself. Hey, I want to get raises, but I'm not going to do anything. So it goes hand in hand, right? That's taking responsibility for and accountability for what you do. I've also, one of the things I've really focused a lot on is how to listen to people without giving them solutions. Because, and I always tell people to say, you don't want the victory to be mine. You want a vent, come to me. If you want me to fix something, tell me. But I will always give you the advice so that the victory isn't mine. Because there was a point, by the way, if somebody came to me, I was like, I'm going to call so-and-so, I'm going to do it, and it's done. And then I realized, actually, I'm not doing anybody any sort of, doing everybody a disservice. And that I've really spent a ton of time sort of focusing on, which is how do you grow other people is not by fixing their problems, but by helping them fix their own problems. So the victories and the learning is theirs, not mine.
That's beautiful. Dev, we end with the same three questions. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
That's not one of the questions. Question number one is, what is the word or phrase of advertising jargon that makes your skin crawl?
We're going to have MarTech implementation where the data journey and the systems integration of human behavior is going to create targeted solutions that will drive growth exponentially. I don't know what the fuck I just said, but whatever the hell that is.
I hope someone actually has said that exact, that just was so top of mind for you that I feel like someone said that to you today.
No, nobody said it. But you know what I mean? Like when you hear these sentences that you just go, what was that?
Yeah. That's good. All right. Question number two, what is the most, you said, hey, where there's going to be bad meetings, it's not the end of the world. Duly noted. For you, what was the most memorably disastrous or horrifying response you ever received in a client meeting?
You mean there's one? First, I'm going to tell you a different story. I told my husband was pitching a hedge fund, like he was in the hedge fund business. So they were raising money. He comes home one day in a really bad mood. And I said, what happened? And he goes, they said no. I'm like, what? He goes, they said no. I'm like, come work in advertising. Like, just come for a little while. I don't know, Amit, and I saw, you know, you told me you're going to ask me this question. So many times I've been in meetings where I've presented a strategy where I thought, fuck, I had like, you know, solved like this big problem and all the clients are sitting there. I think the most humiliating thing is when somebody has nothing to say. And you know, when you get this sort of this stone face, to me, that's been my most humiliating. I tell me it's shit. I'm fine with that, right? But one new business pitch, they told us to wait. They told us to wait. They went out and never came back.
Oh.
Never came back.
And how long did you wait in the room?
I think it was about 45 minutes and we let ourselves out of the building and they were like, I guess that didn't go so well.
I've asked this question 50 something times and I've heard a lot of answers, but I've never heard that.
Just never came back.
And the final question, you've always been someone who stayed close to the work, who loves the work, as you said. This question is called The One That Got Away. It could be from any chapter of your career. What is your all-time favorite idea that, for whatever reason, it never got made, but it still lives in your heart? You still think about it.
Oh my God. There's about sort of, there's about, I don't know, 10, 12, 20 of those ideas. I'll tell you one idea, maybe about 5-10 years ago that I was so utterly in love with. And it was, you know, I think it was a moment in advertising where, and it's just on the heels of, I'd say, Fearless Girl around that moment. It was melting ice sculptures with heads of state. And the ice sculptures would melt, you know, as a signifier of sort of the climate issues. I just still think about that image and love it. And then there's about 20 others. But you know what? I don't bemoan that. And I'll tell you why. Because I think for every idea that we didn't make that led to an idea we made.
Sure. I remember the melting ice sculptures. It was, at some point, it was almost like a Mount Rushmore.
It was
Mount Rushmore. Kind of thing, right, in the Arctic.
And we tried, and then we were going to sink the stock exchange for Climate Week, and that almost got done. That was another brilliant sort of idea. But again, I always feel like every time an idea doesn't get made, something else happens later. And maybe that's my experience because of Fearless Girl, because you know the story, she was a cow, then she became Fearless Girl, or the Lockheed bus that was meant to be a plane, then became a train, then became, you know, the field trip to Mars, that ideas continue to evolve. And there's always an incarnation of that idea that was brilliant that sort of shows up somewhere else.
Yeah, that's right. I think early in your career, you lament every setback and every no. And the truth is, it's like, if you can just stay on the path, figuring out why no is no while remaining on the path will lead you to a new solution that maybe retains the essence of what you loved about the original idea. And how often do we lament no? And then the idea actually gets produced and we think to ourselves, this is actually way better than the thing I was in love with 6 months ago.
Always. Right. And I want to say one thing in our industry is no is just not now.
Yeah. Unless they walk out of the room.
Unless they then I think it's not even no, it's just, well, I was going to say something, but it's not now.
Yeah.
And I think you've had this experience and all of us have where that became that, then somehow became something else. And then, you know, 3 years later, and then you go, oh, wait, that was like an amalgamation of all of this. Yeah, no, and I think one thing that Rob probably has drilled into my head, like it takes 100 ideas to make one.
Yeah.
You need 100 ideas and then you get sort of, and if there's feedback, make it better, make it better, make it better, which this thing that he always says, well, if they didn't like this, let's give them a better one. Like, I always go, there's something sort of super liberating about that way of looking at it. And sometimes there's just, you know, pure disappointment, and that's fine.
Yeah, we want to believe everything is predicated on talent, and talent is critical, but it's as important as persistence and perseverance and luck.
Luck and timing are so important, so important, so important.
All right, Dev, we're going to end it here. You know, I'll say toward the end of my time at McCann World Group, you know, you and I developed a bond and a closeness in ways that we probably can't divulge. You were quintessential in encouraging me to follow my dream of starting my own agency. And through that process, you became a friend and a mentor. And I'm proud to know you, and I've learned a lot from you. And I'm grateful for my friendship with the first ever Devika Bulchandari.
Yeah. And Omid, ditto, I feel the same way. I absolutely and utterly loved and was inspired by your conviction to do something that had never been done before. And I think even when you and I had that conversation, and I was like, you got to go do this on your own, but you got to do it, right? Because it had to be done. And as I watch what you're doing and see you and Majority scale new heights, it makes me so happy. But I know one day we're going to work together. So I will leave it at that.
That's a deal. Great talking to you, my friend. Talk
soon. Okay. Bye, Amin.
Bye.
All right. Thank you so much to my friend, Deb. Thank you, as always, to JSM Music and the executive producer of this podcast, my friend, Jeff Fiorello. And as always, folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, share it with a friend. I will tell you, I was just in Cannes, and to meet creatives from around the world who've somehow stumbled upon this podcast and gleaned some little bit of inspiration from it was an incredibly humbling experience for me. So please share it with anyone you know who enjoys working in this industry, or share it with someone who wants to quit this industry, and maybe this will reel them back in. And until we talk again, peace.